Greetings from Earth and welcome to the Creative Cosmos radio show. What a night to be on the radio, and we have a great 2 hours full of information for you. Fascinating topics and a great guest in hour two, Jerry E. Smith. And I just finished reading the book of his and his friend George Picard's called Secrets of the Holy Land. The Spear of Destiny in History and Legend in hour two. We're going to talk about that book and the amazing journey through history of the Holy Lance, the Spear of Destiny. We're going to find out what it is and if it's still playing a role in world affairs. Again, we're going to be speaking with him hour two, but if you'd like to get a head start on checking out his information, I'll give you all the sites here. www.jerryesmith.com is one. Here's an easy one. He gave me this one to be real clear for the listeners to just pop right in. It's called spearbook.com. And I'll link you right to the site that has the book, which is called secretsoftheholylance.com. And he's got a great publishing company that he works for, called Adventures Unlimited Press, and their site is simply www.adventuresunlimitedpress.com. All right, and along the theme of the Spear of Destiny and hour one today, I am going to speak about how destiny is played in my life, because right now I am also meeting destiny. And I'm going to share my experiences in that regard, which will run through all types of realms and experiences. And hopefully by sharing that, it might assist somebody out there and seeing themselves a little differently or opening to new territory or possibilities. Hopefully my story will inspire and just be entertaining. It's a very reflective time for me. I'm winding things down in the city of Minneapolis, heading out west, and we'll talk about that. But as always, I like to begin by taking a perusal through the site, the big site, the big site, creativecosmos.org. And I thank you, those of you who come visit it. My numbers of visitors have been going up and up, and the forums have been buzzing lately, and all kinds of great information, and I know people have been writing me, and there's just great communication going on out there these days, and I'm very glad to be a part of it. And there's a great internet community and many sites, and it's just wonderful what's happening out there. So cruise on over to creativecosmos.org, and you go down the page a little bit, of course you'll see Jerry E. Smith's information, and I have all his links there, so if you don't want to remember them, just go to them off of my site. Of course, we have them on BBS Radio. That's our home. That's where we live. That's where we love. That's where we learn. BBSRadio.com. Oh, yeah, and then also on my site, I put the archive from my interview last week with Anita Eubank right up on my own site, because I wanted to share that with you, because it was a wonderful experience and we both felt the energy, and it was very enlightening. You know, she did a reading for me that I've been thinking about all week, and she had many wonderful things to say about her book, The Rainbow of Hope. So yeah, you can check that out on my website too, the interview with Anita Eubank. But down towards the bottom, I want to point mention to Secrets of the Galaxy 9. Many of you might be aware of my Secrets of the Galaxy series I've been working on lately, tuning into the stars. Of course, these kind of followed on the idea of my original series called Solar System Secrets, which is when I started receiving the vibrations of the sun, the transmissions of the sun. And although it may sound wondrous and fascinating at first, it gets even better. Because any one of us could tune into the vibrations of the sun. They're out there all the time. It's not that the sun doesn't share those vibrations with us. It's that we fail to tune into them. It's not simply light in the sky. There are more subtle vibrations with wisdom messages. If you want to find out about what happened in the solar system before you were here, or some of the plan for the Earth that runs in cosmic cycles. You know, where do you think the yogis get this information? You know, seemingly they pull it out of thin air, or they just know it, or something. But, you know, they're also communicating with beings. They're communicating with the sun and stars and planets and angels and maybe some contacting demons. Really, when you start seeing demons, you see them all around. The good thing is they're not that powerful. All you have to do is remain centered and aware. And they have no ability to do anything at all to us. In fact, if anything, you can use them simply as an opportunity to remember yourself and stay centered. But more likely, when you call in angels to help you on your path, you know, just simply say, hey, I know you're there. It doesn't have to necessarily be any kind of crazy phrase or anything. You just have to say, hey, you don't even have to say it. You just have to intend it. I know you're there, and my channel's open. I'll take your assistance. That'd be great. Thanks. Next thing you know, there'll be more in your life all the time. And you'll just be able to tell how you'll have a tendency for things to go well or to go better than they did before. You just feel it. You'll learn how to feel those vibrations if you don't already. Many of you are already feeling them, and it's just a matter of interpretation, placing what you sense. Also, up on the top right-hand corner of the creativecosmos.org website, I always rotate through the news stories, scattering of interesting things I find across the web, a few of my older articles, and interesting science-related matters, such as the first story, Strap-on Stealth Wings. It's a story about how the special forces are adapting stealth technology to this bat-like wing that they use instead of parachutes. And there's a picture right with the story of a man in a suit wearing a stealth wing, and they talk about how they just glide in, and that's something they're developing. I find the application of technology fascinating, and I love to see those pictures of interesting technologies, you know. I wish more of them would be applied to the domestic side of our lives, to making our lives better and not to destruction, that's for sure. Perhaps as mysticism and science meet and we continue to share and build bridges, we together will rise out of the old paradigm and start creating the higher dimensional world that we all know exists. There's a really interesting story called Flunking the Art of War by John Walsh. Got it off the counterpunch.org website. He had two titles, kind of, and I picked the one calling Flunking the Art of War. But there was another title called Master Sun Tzu, President Hu, and Bush. And this is a little different take on world affairs. The president of China gave W a copy of Sun Tzu's Art of War. And then the author, John Walsh, quotes a segment about how you don't want to take your troops into a foreign land and stay there for a long time and get them depleted and then all the kind of things of exactly what's happening right now. It's pretty interesting. Because, you know, when you give somebody a book, if I give somebody a book, it's not without purpose. I don't just buy any random book and hand it to somebody. You know, sometimes I try to prescribe books as a medicine, almost, as meditational medicine. You know, I feel the person's energy, interact with them, talk with them about what's happening, and write about where I hear they are and exploring or something that I know helped me along the way. I say, hey, check out this book. Or maybe I just buy the book, you know, buy a friend a book. What's the big deal? $5, $10, $20? Make some friends, build some bonds, share. You know, if you read a book and you find it fascinating, give it to a friend or buy another one. You know, but this is kind of interesting, you know, the president of China gave that book to President George W. What do you think of that? I'll leave it there. Let you mull over that for a moment. So I'd also like to mention that the Transcendence World Movement radio show is going to have a guest on Monday. I'd like you to tune in and catch it. Henrik Palmgren is going to be on. Of course, his site, www.red-ice.net, has just continued to grow, and they have amazing articles. He brings amazing articles through, and he's a creative person, and I feel like he's a partnership with the creative cosmos, and together we're sailing the cosmic seas, bringing information to anybody and everybody who will listen. And if you're out there listening to me tonight and you feel like joining the show, giving me a call, here's the number, 877-876-5227. So, here we are, my life. I'm on the threshold of a move to California, and I've been in Minneapolis for about 6 years. And this is actually the longest I've really ever stayed anywhere since leaving my home originally and going out into the world. I've been bopping around from city to city. Of course, those of you familiar with my story, I've mentioned it. I spent much time in university life. Got degrees at Central Michigan and Michigan State, master's there, and spent some time at the University of Illinois. Just about finished a doctorate, but hey, when the time comes, when you hear the call, you gotta follow the call, and that's what happened to me. There I was at the threshold of finishing the doctorate, which was the end of a long series of events for me leading up to what would have been a professorship at a university. You know, as it was, I took some interviews and got in the finals for a couple trumpet teaching jobs at major universities, and I could have just got one of those jobs, went there, just played the trumpet and relaxed for 30 years. Of course, I would have had to do work, and maybe I would have moved here to another job, and who knows what I would have done. It might have been a good career. But right as I was feeling the pinnacle of success, because I was not only finishing this degree or well on the way, I was also teaching at the University of Illinois classes and other colleges, and I was playing trumpet in orchestras and doing what I had been charged to do in life. And this is a point I love to bring up on the show and like to talk about and share, because I think many people get into a similar situation of where circumstance through their early life puts them on some kind of a course for a certain kind of a job. You know, maybe even when they were young, they thought that's what they wanted to do, but when they got more mature, they started feeling other things, but couldn't make the change. I personally believe that's a huge, huge factor in American society. So many people aren't doing the job they love. They're not doing their heart's calling. You know, that's why the prescription drugs, that's why so many people are taking those heavy-duty drugs and zoning into the TV sets and losing themselves in numbness. Because they've lost their heart. They've lost track of their heart. And after a while, when it's become dark, the mind takes over and starts really getting ingrained and driving these patterns, and you don't even know that there's an alternative. You know, so here I was on this course, and I never questioned it for a very long time. And I was getting pretty old at this point, at least I thought so at the time. Now I look at it, I don't think so, but, you know, I was in my early 20s, heading to mid-20s, when I started tuning into the universe. I had my first glimpses of awareness. And then I had a decision to make. And it wasn't easy. What was I going to do now? Because these understandings were definitely not compatible with what I was feeling as I was living that old life. Something new was happening. I suddenly felt like I didn't fit into that role anymore, and doing it felt like suffering. And, you know, the mind might rationalize that kind of suffering, like, well, you gotta do something to make a living, or you gotta do what you can to survive, or, you know, well, you just start compromising your ideal, and you start just accepting the circumstance, and it kind of does numb you after a while. But I chose to make the leap. I chose to quit what I was doing, leave that whole world behind, and move to Minneapolis. And we're going to talk more about that and what happened once I got here. But first, we're going to play one of my tunes, one of my favorite tunes, when I was thinking about you, the listening audience tonight. Into my mind popped this song, and I wanted to share it. It's one of my personal favorites. It's called Free Mind, Sunshine. Welcome back, everybody, to the Creative Cosmos Radio Show. Another Friday night, exploring all areas of mental space. Tonight's show I called Meeting Destiny. For one reason, because hour two we're going to have Jerry E. Smith on. We're going to be talking about his book, Secrets of the Holy Lance. Boy, that's going to be interesting. I've got a lot of questions for him. Enjoyed it a whole lot. Check it out, spearbook.com. Spearbook.com. Check it out. And follow along with the show if you'd like to creativecosmos.org. And as always, I'm your host, Christopher Morris. Sailing the ship. And we're talking in this section about how I left my old life because it was feeling restrictive, and I went with my new inner inclination. Now, I want to explain something about that. That wasn't instantaneous, you know. First, when I started figuring out that something bigger was going on, I did what you must do. Deprogram. Traced every single thought in my head back to where it came from. And every time I thought it wasn't mine, I let it go. And it doesn't necessarily happen that easy while you're doing it. You know, mental habits really have a way of convincing you of their reality, of their existence, of their necessity. Eventually you realize it wasn't necessary at all, and that a healthy mind is a quiet mind. And then you can keep your energies and not waste them in the grooves of 3D. As a good friend, Indian in the Machine says, we are on a journey to 5D. Why would we want to stay in 3D? Or something like that. He's going to come back on the show, he told me. I'm going to schedule him after my move, but look for him in the days ahead. I'm going to have him on. Hopefully I can convince him to just come on for the whole time and we can play some music and catch up on what he's doing and really hear his enlightened thoughts as he reveals to us what he's been up to. It's going to be great. Keep an eye out for that or an ear out for that. Join us on BBS Radio. Yeah, BBS Radio, everybody. Or as Don likes to say sometimes, BBS, baby. Cool, BBS Radio. All right. And so, as I was speaking about this, so first I deprogrammed my thoughts. Okay, then I started facing into the emotional arena, which is another matter entirely. And I've spoken about this, and I'll continue speaking about this. How energy gets traumatized or frozen, or if you're young and there are invasive energies which press in upon you, you have to one day go back and restore that and reclaim that. One thing we haven't quite figured out yet, but we're working on it, is how to give each other the space and understanding we need to. But you see, this comes from your own understanding of life. When you understand life and the greater forces at work, when you become a part of life, you don't harm life. You wish the best for other life. You help other life. You serve other life. And truly, it makes you feel good. And you don't do this as a rule or as an obligation. So many have misconstrued that. And they do pious acts with a wicked heart. And I say unto thee, that is not what is meant. You serve in joy. You have so much to share. You're aware of life and tune into your energy and doing what you love to do, it spills over in joy. And you share. And then others share with you and you learn to give them space to express themselves. And you listen. And you tune into what they're saying. And it's not just about the words or the details. You feel the resonant vibration of the auric fields in the room together. You feel their emotional state. You see what lies behind their eyes. Communication is a multifaceted and many-dimensional phenomenon. You know, sometimes you hear someone speaking in a very absent-minded way, and it doesn't mean much. But yet they will give themselves equivalent karma for the choice to speak whatever it is they have spoken. Manifesting words Oh, no. It's quiet?
It's so quiet after that little storm.
Don, are you out there?
Sometimes it takes a little while. So
hey, friends. I'm back. We had a little delay there. One of the idiosyncrasies of the studio. Boy, it's interesting. I was just sharing some of the thoughts I've been reflecting upon lately regarding my own life's transition. Maybe before the break, before the tune, some of you were listening and heard me speak about where I got to a point in my life where I got tired of the old way I was doing things, which was kind of initiated by the circumstances of my early life. And I had a choice to make, whether I could make the leap out of it or whether I would allow the old habits to take root and to bring me into that. And let me say, it doesn't happen overnight. The first thing you got to do is examine your thoughts and trace back every thought to where it came from. And when you see that it wasn't yours in the first place, then you have to let it go. And this isn't always. You have to keep at it. Sometimes you'll have to get ahead of the thought. You know, first it will fire, and it will take you on a journey with it. Then the next time the thought occurs, you get ahead of it a little bit. You see it, you might get irritated by it, but you don't go all the way. And then the next time it comes up, and you just let it go. And one by one, you take every one of these thoughts, and you unravel them, and you free them. Because the healthy mind is a quiet mind. And you also have to go over your emotions as well. And some, particularly in this American society, haven't learned to give each other the space they need and the understanding they need to live a full life, to live a happy life. We crowd each other out. We push on each other. So, also, when we come to share, we want to share because it arises in our heart, because we're so full of joy in what we're doing. Some out there have gotten a wrong idea, and they think of it as an obligation or as a rule, or they serve the idea of serving rather than truly serving one another. And you come to truly serve one another when you come to understand life, when you choose to become a part of life itself, then you recognize the life within each of us. And you truly do feel, when you help somebody out, that you are helping yourself out. And you see how those thoughts and judgments of the past were harmful, and it's good to get space from that. And then after you clear out the old, you don't have that old impetus driving you forward yet. And this was the point I had reached after I had become more attuned to the universe, realized that the old way wasn't going to work for me, cleared out all the old habits and many of the emotional hurts, but I didn't have anything driving me forward because the old was gone. It wasn't mine in the first place. It was instigated from the outside. So we have to find all that which was instigated on the outside, which isn't ours, and free ourselves from it. This is why any ideology in the end is harmful to the soul, because it locks you in. It crowds the soul out. It becomes something which you filter everything through, and you never really link to that greater part of yourself. So then you have to tune in that space. Once you free yourself, then you finally have room for the soul to start entering into the body, for you to start hearing that inner voice that we all have. And you just simply have to be patient. You just have to give it time. You can't expect that you're going to sit down once and all of a sudden it's going to be da 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 da. Hey, you're enlightened. Da 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 da. Wake up. Da 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 da. It takes a while to tune in and to hear it and to get the knack of it. And that's fine. It's just how it is. Because the way we perceive time at a frenzied pace in the third dimension has nothing to do with the way the universe moves and the way the cycles on Earth rotate on through. So we need that space to tune in. I'm going to take a little break here and move to my next tune. Hope you enjoy it. It's called When You Need a Hand. Hello and welcome back, everybody. This is Christopher Morris of the Creative Cosmos. Glad you could join us this evening. I'm looking forward very much to Hour 2, which is coming up very soon, where we're going to speak with Jerry E. Smith about his book, Secrets of the Holy Lance, The Spear of Destiny in History and Legend. And I should mention, he wrote this book with a friend of his, George Picard. And we're going to have the music of George Picard's band. He couldn't come in for the interview, but we decided to incorporate him in another way and make him a part of the show. We're going to play some of his band's tunes this evening. That is going to be fun. The name of his band is called The Atomics. Check it out. He's got a lot of free music on there. I'll give it to you again in a minute, but I'll also give it to you now. www.atomics.com. And we are talking about meeting destiny tonight. And I met destiny once, and I met it again, and I am meeting it now. But anyway, sometimes you meet destiny in a big way in your life. And I feel I'm meeting destiny in a big way in my life right now, moving to California. So I'm reminiscing a bit about my time in Minneapolis, sharing with you some of my growth experience. And I was first talking to you about how I reached that critical point in my life of where I had to make a decision. I recognized the truth in my heart, and that I long to be on a path with more meaning. And I could have chose to stay in my old course and be miserable, or make the leap, which wasn't easy to make. And my moving to Minneapolis in the first place back in July of 2000 was me making a leap. I had discarded the old, all the old thoughts, all the old feelings. And, well, you know, some feelings I had yet to work through, but that was the idea. I was making a leap to do just that, to really find the purpose and meaning in my life. And so I moved and started over from scratch. You know, I had all the experience and knowledge, which now is great because I can draw from that and use that information and from the Spirit illuminate things in a very interesting way, using all that which I had learned. But unless I had jumped out of it, I would have been trapped by it, you see, and then it would have kept me locked into simply living life through the mind. And I personally think America itself is right on that threshold, you know. Many people are stuck living on the mind, living in the mind, and so certain rationalizations make sense to them. But, you see, the heart doesn't speak in terms of rationalizations. It speaks in terms of love. And love contains the mind as well. And everything in the mind, and all that you used to like about the mind, is set free and more in love. And that's what we're talking about here on the Creative Cosmos and on BBSRadio.com. We're talking about love. You know, and not just talking about it. We're loving. We're expressing. We're creating. And it's catching on. We see it, you know. All the hosts are getting lots of emails about their shows, and BBS is just becoming more and more a part of people's lives. Because you see, that is where the healing is happening. And so what I needed when I made the leap to Minneapolis to begin anew was to stand behind myself, to believe in myself. Because, you know, if you come to that point in your life where you're ready to make a big change, it's very likely that a lot of people around you will think you flipped or think that something weird is going on or might think it's a bad idea, particularly if you have some kind of interest, like having been somewhere for a long time. And so there's plenty of rationalizations why it's better to stay with the old, but there are always rationalizations to say stay with the old. I say unto thee, people of earth, this is life. It's time to wake up, get on board. This is what you're here for. You're not here to be messing around and living as shadows and ghosts across the land, bickering with one another, spitting in each other's faces, and perhaps even killing them from a distance. Come on, that's not the destiny of humanity. Recognize your dignity and the gift and opportunity you have in this moment. You hear my voice right now. Cherish the gift of your life. And in those years in Minneapolis, I discovered the creative cosmos. You see, I didn't prefabricate or anything like that. I found it. It found me. It came up through me. You know, I started... One of the things that really got me about my old life is it was very specialized. I just did kind of very specific kind of a thing. You know, I taught trumpet and I played in one kind of a way most of the time. You know, I learned other kinds of ways. That was the first part of my expansion, is beginning to play music in many kind of ways. And after a while, I didn't need to just play it on the trumpet anymore. I could play it on anything. That was the beauty. That was the joy. I became a musician. And then I realized that even music itself was not the only palette from which I could draw. I began to draw. I began to sketch. And I realized in my early life, when I was very young, and look for this in your life if you're seeking your destiny, what you're truly meant to do. Look in your earliest days. What were you doing? What did you feel drawn to? What did you just come up with, you know? Before you went into ego and into the world and were convinced by everybody of everything else. You know, one way to kind of cleanse my palate in that regard, I think to myself, what would happen if I was the only person in the world? What would I come up with? Because the truth of life must be so that each could discover it intrinsically, or else where did it come from? Perhaps at one time or another, you know, some specific person attains the ability, and so people are enamored, yet any could do so, and any who has attained it has said that. And so I began to draw and watch images come through my pen of a whole other world, a whole other universe. And it was wondrous to behold, to allow my imagination free rein, to go with every whim and inclination, to let the muse write the poetry it had so longed to express, because this is where I had a next. into the realm of words, into the realm of expression. And I noticed after looking back that many times in my life I had written a series of articles. I still have them, you know, maybe from the early 90s I have a chunk of articles, from the late 90s I got a chunk of articles, and from these early days of my explorations I have a chunk of articles. And hopefully I'm going to rework some of those as part of a book project that I'll be sharing with people one day. Anything that I've created that's worth preserving, I'll do my best with while I have the time here to preserve. Because, see, this is also something, too, in this creative process, I found purpose and meaning, you know, a reason to get up tomorrow. I've got to work on this deal. I've got a mission. I've got something to do, you know, a higher calling. And, boy, I know that hearts out there are longing for that higher calling. And I say again that the universe is splendid, and what you hoped was true is true. That's one of the beauties of this radio chair, is that I can tell you the good news. Maybe some of you heard my tune. I got good news. I got good news. I got good news. I got good news. And it kicks his pipe and goes, roll the stone. Roll the stone. Roll the stone away. And of course, that's reference to Jesus to some extent, but also what else? Roll the stone away. Roll that past away, roll that burden away, because that's also what did Jesus do? He ascended at that point or after that point. In the story anyway, perhaps he did, you know? But what do we talk about on the internet right now? That thing, ascension. You hear that word all the time in the channel of messages. What is that? Can we ascend as well? I say yes. I feel it. I know others feel it. And we're excited to share it. And we're excited to share it with you. That's what we're all about. Hey. So in my Minneapolis period, I discovered what it was I was meant to do. And I was strong enough to stand behind it. And now that the source is pouring forth, life is good. It always was. But now I've caught up. I'm aligned. I'm in tune. I'm in harmony. And once you find what it is you're meant to do and are strong enough and heroic enough to take on your own mythos and make it happen, that is the ascension to some extent as well, because that is how we set free all these latent psychic abilities, for one. If you meditate and do what you love to do and open up your heart and joy, I guarantee you, you're going to get all kinds of psychic abilities. You know, when you hear about someone giving a reading or something, maybe in the past we thought that was a rarity. It isn't going to be so much longer. It's going to become the norm. We're all going to get used to psychically perceiving each other and sharing these messages. I mean, one, it's a lot of fun to hear. You know, and we serve each other in that way as well. If we can be open and free and not bring the coloring of the mind into play, you know, our own personal judgment based on personal circumstance. See, that's what corrupts a message. And maybe once in a while, some messages out there will have streaks of that. But it's up to you to be true to yourself. And, you know, everyone's doing what they can for the cause. And also, towards the end of my Minneapolis period, well, it's coming up in a couple days now, going to paradise, but I tell you, maybe a little longer ago, I consider kind of 2005 my last full year, and things really did start to change at that point. And one of the reasons why was Big Don contacted me June 10th. It's almost been a year, Happy anniversary, Don. You're out there in radio land. Thanks for contacting me and opening your heart.
Oh, I love you. Thank you. I love you.
Changed my life. Big time. So I'm thrilled to be involved in BBS, and you know, I started posting on the TNT board, and then got into the Question the Experts, and then started doing the show, and then I realized that I was a part of this, that I was meant to work with these guys, and Don and Doug, and they felt it too, and now we're going to make it happen. We're going to work together. And we're working with many people, with all the great hosts, and more people coming on board all the time, and, you know, listeners, and people posting on the boards, and people just passing through, reading things, and, boy, it's just a huge vortex of the highest energies. I see it forming, and that's what we set out to do, you know, with the shows early on, the first month, October, November, you know, even earlier. I know there were a few shows way back when, April, May, even, maybe. So it's great, great, great to be a part of, and I'm here to help you, you know, to any hosts tuning in or anybody listening. That's what I'm going to be there for, and, you know, we're going to be sharing in the taking care of things for sure. So I'd like you to feel free to contact me with anything at all, and this is coming up. So it's interesting to watch one phase of your life, and it's kind of pass into another and actually be conscious of every idiosyncrasy of the experience, you know, watching it and being aware of it. Doesn't mean you don't sometimes feel some kind of, you know, pain of change, you know, big change, you know, really makes you aware of your attachments, you know. As a monk, I try to be non-attached and use everything as a lesson, and that's what I'm using this experience for, and each moment for. And I hope that I've inspired you with my story to do the same. And hey, I mentioned a little bit earlier that I was going to play the music of the co-author of the book we're going to be talking about in just a few moments, George Picard's band, The Atomics. So it's a good time that we're going to head to his first tune of the evening. And I listened to a few of his tunes on his website. Check it out, atomiks.com. There's a bunch of free music there, really good stuff. And the first tune we're going to play tonight is called Operator. Get me Jesus on the line. Enjoy. Welcome back to the Creative Cosmos Radio Show, everybody. And as I promised, hour two, we're going to have Jerry E. Smith on, and let's get right to it. I'm going to read a little bio, give you his links, and then we'll welcome him on the show. Jerry E. Smith has been a writer, editor, and activist for over three decades. In the early 1990s, he was the executive director of the National UFO Museum in Reno, Nevada. His bibliography of published works includes scores of articles and reviews, over a dozen ghost-written books, and two nonfiction works from Adventures Unlimited Press: HARP, The Ultimate Weapon of the Conspiracy, and Secrets of the Holy Lance, The Spear of Destiny in History and Legend. The latter was co-authored with George Picard, who wrote Liquid Conspiracy, JFK, LSD, CIA, Area 51, and UFOs. And to find out more, check out some of Jerry's links, www.jerryesmith.com. And this was the easy one to remember. Here we go. Spearbook.com. And then there's secretsoftheholylance.com. And, of course, adventuresunlimitedpress.com. Welcome to the show, Jerry.
Well, hi. Good to be with you.
Yeah, thank you. I just finished up your book today, and I have to say it was amazing tale. I couldn't believe how much of history was worked into it.
Oh, well, thanks. There was quite an effort between George and I, and you're right. There's an amazing amount of stuff in there. I mean, we got 2,000 years of European history, and it's not just in the history. I mean, it's ongoing today at this very moment.
Yeah. Yeah, I noticed that you brought that back around at the end, how some of these energies are still in play today.
Righto.
Yeah, and how did you guys go about writing it together? Like, what method did you use? Was some of it your words, some of it his, or did you kind of bounce off each other? Or?
Well, the way it worked is George, as you mentioned, his previous book was Liquid Conspiracy, was largely about the aftermath of Operation Paperclip, which brought Nazi spy masters and rocket scientists
right.
to the U.S. at the end of World War II.
Mm-hmm.
And so there's the story, Secrets of the Holy Lance, the Spear of Destiny in History and Legend, is about the spear that pierced the side of Christ, and this became an obsession with both Adolf Hitler and Heinrich Himmler. And so the Nazi aspect of the story is one of the key aspects that people are interested in. And since George had written a book about the aftermath of World War II, I offered splitting the book with him. He writes the Nazi stuff, and I write everything else.
Ah.
That was the original division point.
Okay.
As it turned out, both of us, to get our feet wet, we both wrote The Crucifixion. And so we both wrote the same first chapter. We both wrote the Crucifixion, and I like George's version much better. So like the first four or five words, the first four or five pages in the Crucifixion section, that's mine, and then it goes into George, and George got on a roll, and like the next five chapters are George.
Wow. Well, that's always good though.
So he wrote The Crucifixion and the immediate aftermath, what happened in the first 100 years. And then he wrote the Nazi stuff, and I wrote basically everything else.
Okay.
And the way it worked was we each drafted a first draft of our section and then passed it to the other. And George would write his first drafts, pass them to me, and I would add stuff. I'm a windy SOB. And I would write my first drafts and pass them to George, and he would subtract stuff, which I thought hilarious. So I really got into Constantine, and the Constantine really laid the foundation of Christianity. Christianity is the way it is in no small part because of Constantine.
Yeah, I found that part of the book really illustrative part, because he went very much into the details of how that all played itself out, which I had found fascinating, because some of those subtleties I wasn't aware of before.
And I went, I actually went a whole lot deeper. George axed about 35 pages out of that section. Because there were some amazing things. I mean, it was the War of the Emperors. And at one point, there were like 9 emperors, and basically offing each other. And I really got into trying to figure out the politics and who did what where and the strange twists. And I really found it fascinating. And George was going, you know, what does this have to do with the spear?
I mean,
blue
it's
pencil,
a good point,
pencil,
too.
Blue pencil.
It's a good point to bring up just how all that was into play. And then how it ended just happened to be how Christianity was what won out. And then I enjoyed these little illustrative comments, too, these little interjections of how, and that's how we all got Christianity today. Every once in a while, one of you throws in a little comment that helps lock it in like that.
Yeah, we both had as our mentor Jim Keith. Jim Keith was our best friend, best buddy, and I'd known Jim since high school. Jim died under suspicious circumstances in 1999, a few days before his 50th birthday.
Mm.
And George had been George's best friend for about 8-10 years before he died. He'd been mine for 30. I had worked with Jim on quite a number of his books, and indeed, it was hard for some people to tell our styles apart. In fact, one of his books, he had written an introduction to the book, and then he didn't like his introduction, and the publisher wanted the book, the manuscript, in 3 days, and he just couldn't bring himself to do it. So he throws the book at me and asks me to write his introduction. So I wrote the introduction to his book, and of course I was never supposed to mention it, so I won't tell you which book it is.
Okay. Well, I'm definitely going to check out some of Jim's books now after reading. You mentioned some things about him, I think, in your foreword to the book, and also somewhere on your website. And I'm going to check out some of his work. Thanks for bringing that up.
Yeah, our styles are very much like his. In fact, when George submitted his manuscript to our publisher, our publisher thought George was a pseudonym for Jim Keith. The publisher thought that George was that Jim was just trying to, you know, pull a fast one on him and get an extra paycheck, you know. And so when Jim died, the publisher didn't send the royalty check to George because he didn't think George existed.
Oh, wow.
And so the publisher didn't actually discover George was a real person until he wrote him saying, you know, where is my check?
Boy, that's funny. Well, I'm sure you guys have both incorporated his spirit in your work. It's obvious that he's still with you as you carry forth the work.
Right. And so part of Jim's way of doing things was to try to find the deeper meaning in things. Describe the surface stuff as amusingly as possible, and to look as deep in as possible. So that's what we tried repeatedly to do throughout the book.
Well, I found it to be, as you mentioned, George, cutting things down, I did find it to be very dense and very scholarly in that way, that so much information is packed into so little space. That's really obvious in that regard.
Yeah, I was really amazed. You know, the book began September 04. I am here in Kempton, Illinois, the worldwide headquarters for Adventures Unlimited, at this very moment, working on my next book, which is Weather Warfare: The Military's Plan to Draft Mother Nature. And I was working on that book summer of 04 when in September I got a call from David Hatcher Childress, our publisher, who said, you know, right now, with the Da Vinci Code and all, anything Christian is big, and I'm really selling Trevor Raven's Cross, Spear of Destiny, and the follow-up book, Mark of the Beast, and these strange books by Howard Buchner, Adolf Hitler and the Secrets of the Holy Lance. And my publisher was not actually publishing those books. He was only selling them, right? So he's only making a few cents a copy because he didn't print them. So he asked me, well, look, can you write me a book about the spear? Because then he would publish it and he'd be able to make dollars per copy instead of pennies per copy. So I said, oh, sure, yeah, because I had read Trevor Ravenscroft's Spear of Destiny when it came out back in the early 70s, and I had been following a variety of metaphysical paths. And, you know, Trevor Ravenscroft's book was about, Trevor was an occultist, and it was about his initiation into the occult, and about Adolf Hitler's initiation into the occult, and I think by extension, the reader's initiation. And so I'm not an occultist, but I'm a pretty broad.
You're aware of various phenomena, sort of.
Right. I've been practiced. I actually ran for county commissioner on a Taoist ticket. If you believe that. So I've.
Oh, that'd have been nice.
Yeah, I've done a. I've been through half a dozen religions and ordained in two of them. So I'm fairly deep into this thing, and so I recognize there was a lot of spiritual truths and a lot of Bullwinkle as well. And also because of the work I did with Jim, into conspiracy theory and parapolitics and so forth, and realized that there was some very deep, broad issues here. And what I do as a writer, I write about the control freaks. I write about the people who do not believe that you and I are capable of freedom, that we really do need to be controlled, and that they would be better. It would be better off for them if they were controlling us.
Yeah.
And so that's what I write about. My book, HARP, The Ultimate Weapon of the Conspiracy, was about how the control freaks could use the most advanced technologies to rule the world. And so when David Hector Childress offered me a chance to write about the Holy Lance, it occurred to me that this would be another chance to write about the control freaks, in this case, those who over the last 2,000 years have been trying to control us using metaphysics and the politics of religion, if you will.
Yeah.
And so I said, yeah, cool, David, I'll do that. And he says, great, I need it in 2 months.
Wow.
Yeah, now it took me 2 years to write HARP. The idea of writing an entire book in 2 months just freaked me out.
Well, there's tons of research in this book, obviously,
and facts
from all sorts of places.
That's when I contacted George. As soon as he said I need it in 2 months, I immediately picked up the phone and called George and said, "Look, I can't possibly write a whole book in 2 months. Can you want to split it with me?" And at this point, you know, George is the leader of a band, the Atomics. You played a track before I came on.
Yeah.
We're going to hear another couple of tracks.
Uh-huh.
And so, in fact, I believe the Atomics are doing a show tonight or tomorrow night.
Oh, cool.
George is a information technology specialist. He's the senior most student in the IT department in his very large medical corporation.
Oh, geez. Wow.
And so he's busy. He's very busy. And he'd been writing for zines and blogs and whatnot, and he decided it would look good in his resume to have another book with his name on it.
Hmm.
So when I asked him, "Do you want to jump in on this?" He goes, "Yeah, that'd look good in my resume, sure." So we decided to split the book since he'd written about the Nazis, he started on the Nazis, and I started on ancient history because I've always been fascinated with ancient history, and we just sort of blended and rolled around each other. It came out very well.
Yeah, I noticed you also wrote in that style of where you jump from one time period to another or to another, and you kind of keep it moving back and forth a little bit that way.
Right. That was, you know, we did a couple of literary devices in this book. We realized that probably the majority of people reading the book their interest would be the Nazi factor. And so we realized that if we do it in straight chronological order, the Nazis don't turn up until the end of the book. And we knew that people wouldn't want to wade through, you know, a bunch of ancient history to get to what they were looking for.
Mm.
So we decided to intersperse it. And so we do ancient history and Nazis. And then ancient history and Nazis and ancient history and Nazis and bring it up to present time. Another aspect of this is that another one of the literary devices we chose to do was we decided to start each chapter with a dramatization, with a fictionalized version of the most important scene in that nonfiction chapter. And then once we had decided to do that, then we realized, well, let's do the whole book like that. And so the book begins with a fictionalized scene from what we think is the most important event in the history of the Spear. And this is, oddly enough, set in Antarctica in 1979.
Yeah, post-World War II, right? Yeah.
Right, so the book begins and ends in 1979, because if that piece of the story is true, then the spear that pierced the side of Christ is not hidden in some church or on display in some museum, but is actually in the hands of a group of post-Nazi occultists who believe that with it they can manipulate, massage, and control the destiny of mankind.
Yeah, that's a scary thought there. Definitely. So, yeah, that's... But as you said, it turns up all throughout history, and World War II seemed to be just one more series of episodes, which makes you wonder about the future, whether it's going to turn up again somewhere.
Righto.
Or where it's going to turn up again. When it, I mean, like you say, somebody probably has it and may be using it right now for various things, but, you know, we'll eventually, it seems like every once in a while it comes to the surface of history as well in these cycles.
Right. Well, to delve into the subject matter, because I hope we're not boring your listeners here with talking about the book they haven't read yet. They probably want to know something about what's inside the book.
Okay.
If the book is Secrets of the Holy Lance, the Spear of Destiny in History and Legend, and the Holy Lance is the spear that pierced the side of Christ as he hung on the cross. And in the Gospel of John, we read that as Christ hung on the cross, it was nearing sunset, the beginning of the Sabbath, and Jewish law required that you could not have a man the words is hanging on a tree during the Sabbath,
mm-hmm.
So that he had to be dead and cut down before sunset. The Sabbath runs from sunset Friday to Saturday night when it's dark enough to see three stars, in case you're wondering what the definition of Sabbath is.
Mm-hmm.
A lot of people think that that going to church on Sunday is keeping the Sabbath. It's not. Sunday is not the Sabbath. The Sabbath is Saturday. Sunday is the Lord's Day, and those who think they're keeping that commandment are sadly mistaken. The Lord's Day was established by Constantine. The Lord is Sol Invictus, the sun god. So and Sunday is Sun Day. It's the day in celebration of the sun. Just as Monday is Moon Day, the day in celebration of the moon.
Mm. Cool. Yeah.
In fact, we have a full or near full moon going on at this very moment. So that.
Oh.
Yeah, you got it. So the story as reported in the Gospels is that the priests were afraid that Jesus would not be dead in time, and they asked Pontius Pilate to send some soldiers to break the legs so the men would die faster. And the way crucifixion works, this is a particularly nasty way to go, in that crucifixion is designed to wear you out mentally, spiritually, as well as physically, because as long as you can keep the way you die in crucifixion is you suffocate to death. Your weight pulling on your arms constricts the chest muscles, and you suffocate.
Yeah.
So as long as you can push up with your legs and relieve the pressure on your arms, you stay alive. So all day long, you're hanging there in pain, pushing up with your legs, staying alive, knowing that if you just stop doing it, all this will go away. But of course, you know, the sense of self-preservation is very strong, and people do it for hours and hours. But eventually they throw in the towel. And as you recall, Jesus did eventually realize that it was over and admit to that it was time for him to go, and went just as soldiers were coming around to break his legs. Now, it's recorded in John and a couple of other Gospels that as the soldiers came to Jesus after he had died, a centurion stepped forward and stopped them, or a soldier stepped forward and stopped them, and pierced Jesus' side to prove that he was already dead so they wouldn't have to break his legs.
Yeah.
Now, it's in Christian tradition and in the Apocrypha, which are the books that didn't make it into the Bible, such as...
Yeah, I noticed you quoted a lot of different sources on Jesus. I actually really like that because those various texts that were simply edited out for various reasons, and they all have... You just put them out there to consider and let the reader decide for themselves.
Right. So in the Gospel of Nicodemus, it says that the soldier was Gaius Cassius Longinus, and that he was an elderly man going blind from cataracts who had been put on light duty following Jesus around, basic Red Squad domestic surveillance stuff. Does that sound familiar? And he had come to appreciate Jesus, perhaps even worship him.
Mm-hmm.
And when... the soldiers came to break the legs, he stopped them as an act of mercy, and that this was an ignominy that he did not want to be perpetrated on the body.
Yep.
And by stopping them, he fulfilled prophecy by Zechariah had said that of the Messiah, none of his bones would be broken. I have the feeling we're coming up on a break here pretty quickly. So
yeah, a couple more minutes. Go ahead. And,
so there are several spears or several objects claimed to be the spear of Gaius Cassius Longinus scattered
mm-hmm.
around the planet based on various stories of where he went after the crucifixion.
It seems like in the book you were able to pretty much zero in on one as the likely authentic spear.
Well, actually, we decided to, since the world was most familiar with the spear in Vienna that was written about by Trevor Ravenscroft, that we decided to focus on that one as the spear that most people would be interested in.
Right.
But in fact, George and I had very serious debates over the subject because I don't believe any of them are the real deal, I don't want to get any lengthy thing right before we go
right.
to break here.
That's cool. Well, we can leave it kind of there as we go into break. And I also just say that I also notice how in that or you kind of evoke something, you again and again reference something beyond the spear or the force that he evokes or the way it, even if it wasn't the real spear, well, it obviously had some kind of an impact or an effect, and yeah, we can get into all that and some of the ways that plays itself out here after the break. So we're going to go into another tune by George Picard and listen to his band, The Atomics, play the song Swinging on a Friday Night. Enjoy, everybody. Welcome back to the Creative Cosmos Radio Show, everybody. We've been talking with Jerry E. Smith about the book he wrote with his friend George Picard called Secrets of the Holy Lance, The Spear of Destiny in History and Legend. And let me give you out his websites one more time. We have www.jerryesmith.com. And then we have the easy-to-remember spearbook.com. And then we have secretsoftheholylance.com and adventuresunlimitedpress.com. And we welcome back to the show, Jerry E. Smith. Thanks for coming back.
Well, it wasn't that far a walk.
Nah, just a little break. So, yeah, we were talking about the various possible spears or that there was... were legends of this spear and that spear, and maybe one of them was the real one, maybe one of them wasn't, and you were beginning to expound upon that, so maybe
right.
you could speak a little more on that.
Okay, so again, the book, Secrets of the Holy Lance, The Spear of Destiny in History and Legend, and the first thing we tried to do is we tried to nail down all the legend, all the pieces of legend, which included all the various objects that were claimed by this person, that person, the other person, to be the spear.
Mm-hmm.
So we laid out the whole legend and then tried to juxtapose that with known history. So we tried to establish what really took place and what probably is just hyperbole and weirdness. And there's a lot of hyperbole and weirdness. And there are half a dozen objects that are claimed to be the spear. And again, this is based on where the legend says that Gaius Cassius Longinus went after the crucifixion.
Mm-hmm.
One of the objects is in the Vatican, and this story goes that Longinus stayed in the Holy Land when he pierced the side of the Christ, blood and water came out. This is recorded in Gospel of John. In the Gospel of Nicodemus, it explains that when the blood and water came out, it splashed in his eyes and cured his incipient blindness,
uh-huh.
and he became he converted to Christianity on the spot. And so, in the Vatican objects legend, Longinus stayed in the Holy Land and achieved Christian martyrdom there. And that spear was on display in Jerusalem up until Jerusalem was overrun by Muslims in, what was it, the 600s or 700s?
Mm-hmm.
700 or 800s. Around 400, the tip of the spear got broken off and was given to a king who brought it back to what is now France. And that the tip of the spear was on display up until the French Revolution, when it vanished. The body of the spearhead was on display in Jerusalem until it got overrun, and then it disappears until the 1400s. And it's kind of a wild tale. In 14 something or another, the caliph who ruled all of Islam died and left two sons and no clear heir. And as so often happened, the two sons warred over which one was going to be the caliph. And of course, one won and one lost. And
uh-huh.
The loser bugged out, and he went to the Knights Templars. And the Templar Knights quickly realized that he was too hot a potato for them to handle, and they took him to the Vatican. Now, once he got to the Vatican, the winning brother goes, "Uh-oh, this guy could do me a lot of harm if he talks." And so he offered the Pope to buy his brother back, and paid one of the largest ransoms in human history, which was a small mountain of gold, bags of precious gems, and just to sweeten the deal, he threw in the Holy Land. Now, the Holy Land gets to the Vatican mid-1400s, and for the next couple hundred years, there's quite a bit of debate over whether or not it's the real deal. Somewhere in the late 16 or early 1700s, the Pope decides to knock off all this nonsense. He has a decorative roof built over one of his thrones, and this roof is supported by four pillars, and he has the Holy Land embedded in one of the pillars, where it has been for the last couple of hundred years. So there's no way to examine it to find out whether it's the real deal or not. Now, another object is the one that is in Armenia today. There's a little monastery in Armenia that claims to have the Holy Lands. And this story is that Longinus went east following in Paul's footsteps and died in what is now Turkey or Armenia. And his spear went to a local holy man who used it to maintain the Christian community there for a while, and then it vanishes. And again, oddly enough, turns up in the 1400s. In this case, it's a crusader army is in Antioch, one of the great cities of the ancient world, and they are surrounded by a much larger Muslim force. And they're really expecting to get wiped out, and they need something, anything, to get them out of this pickle. And one of the crusaders, who is now known as Saint Bartholomew, tells the commander of the army that Saint Andrew had come to him in a dream and told him that the Holy Lance was under the floor of the church in Antioch, and all they had to do was go rip up the floor and find the Holy Lance, and with the power of Christ, they could beat the Muslim horde. Well, they spend the whole day ripping up the floor and find nothing, and the commander of the army is so pissed he's about to put Bartholomew to the sword when Bartholomew suddenly goes, oh, I know where it is, and he runs over and picks it up. Now, this object has remained in the area of Antioch and is now in this weird little religious enclave in Armenia. The trouble is everybody who's seen this thing says, well, that's not a spearhead at all. It's a standard top. It's a flagpole top. It just looks like a spear. So the likelihood of it being the real deal is fairly slim.
Yeah.
And then there's the one that currently, there's the one that may be in Vienna today. And this is the one that Trevor Ravenscroft wrote about, the one that most people are familiar with. If you saw last year's movie with Keanu Reeves, Constantine, the Spear of Destiny plays a pivotal, crucial role in that movie. In fact, it's one of the stars of the movie. and the replica that they use in that film is just spectacular. It's just so good. Oddly enough, you can actually buy a replica of the Holy Lands on eBay. I've seen several
Do you have a copy?
I thought about it. They have a bit more than I
would. Oh, it seems right that you'd have one.
Yeah. So the one that may be in Vienna, and I say maybe because remember at the beginning of this I said one of the key elements to this story is that it may have been recovered from Antarctic ice in 1979. If that's the case, the one in Vienna is a replica, and the real one is hidden in Europe. And I'll quickly get to that.
Yeah, go ahead. I kind of went with the idea that the one in Austria probably is a replica. It kind of makes sense that they would do something like that and try to carry the, or at least what they thought was the real lance somewhere in their protection.
Exactly. Good. I'm glad I got that across to you. What that story is, that piece of the legend, is that after the crucifixion, Longinus becomes friends with Joseph of Arimathea. It's Joseph who gets Jesus' body and puts him in his own crypt. And this gets Joseph in a great deal of trouble with the Jewish authorities, because not only can you not have a man hanging on a tree during the Sabbath, you can also not bury a man during the Sabbath. And so it's really unlikely that Jesus would have been executed on Friday, because it just violates too many rules. Because if you are executed on Friday, you have to be buried on Friday, or you can't be buried until Sunday. In those days, a body hanging around for 24 hours could get pretty nasty.
Yeah.
So, at any rate, Joseph buries Jesus against local ordinances, and is helped in this crime by Longinus. They leave the Holy Land and go to the British Isles. Joseph is a rich man, and he's apparently a rich man by engaging in the tin trade, and the tin mines were in Britain. So there's a local legend that Glastonbury Abbey was founded by Joseph. There are a number of legends about Joseph, including that the hawthorn tree, which is not native to the British Isles, was brought there by Joseph, that when Joseph pressed his staff into the ground, it sprung out and became the hawthorn tree.
Yeah, so, I remember that. That was pretty early on in the book there. Yeah.
So, The legend goes that after Longinus, the next person to possess the Holy Lance was Queen Boadicea. And Queen Boadicea is a very interesting character, and I wish we had time to go into her story. After Queen Boadicea, the spear disappears for a couple of hundred years and turns up in very odd hands. Which is let me tell you a little bit about Boadicea. Boadicea raised an army of Celts to fight the Romans, and she there are a number of things that the spear, a number of powers the spear is alleged to have.
Yeah, I wanted to ask you about that.
Yeah. The primary legend of the spear is that whosoever possesses this holy lance and understands the powers it serves holds in his hand the destiny of the world for good or evil. And the way this is accomplished, the way one has the destiny of the world in their hand, is they have certain powers. The spear grants its wielder certain powers, and these are invincibility in battle, clairvoyance, clairaudience, precognition, and guidance from the power that reaches through the spear to its wielder. And the first legend established, Queen Boadicea is invincible in battle with it. She slaughters at least 25,000 Romans before being taken in her sleep, and they actually don't succeed in taking her. She escapes, but realizing that she's lost her army, lost the spear, commits suicide.
Mm-hmm. So let's go back to that, the power of the spear a little bit more. You talked a number of different stories of how different possibilities of what actually gives it the power. You know, you spoke at one point about how it was an imprint of an ancient god form, or it was also like maybe even has a consciousness of its own, or imply that it maybe draws this force. So there's all kinds of different ways. So yeah, why don't you talk for a minute about what you think actually gives it its power, or the ways it was supposedly brought to have such influence.
Cool. Yeah, sure. It's actually one of my favorite subjects of the sphere. It kind of began with Trevor Ravenscroft. He spent most of his book on trying to figure out. He was convinced that the opera Parsifal was about a real event, and that there were real people who did something like that around the 10th century. And he became convinced that the Nazi hierarchy were the people, the real characters that the characters in the play Parsifal were based on, and that they were reincarnated from the 10th century into the 19th century and trying to do the same thing again.
Mm.
And he spends a great deal of time trying to figure out who each one was and what their past lives were and yada yada.
Uh-huh.
Well, we don't do that, but there is. One of the things that Ravenscroft did that we pick up on is that Ravenscroft spotted that it seemed to him like some sort of power came through the sphere and directed or wielded the possessor of the sphere, and he decided that this was an evil force, and he called it variously the spirit of the age or the Antichrist. And so we picked up on that, and as I was writing this, I'm a big fan of The Lord of the Rings by J.R.R. Tolkien.
Yeah, great stuff.
And as I'm writing this, I'm realizing there are tremendous parallels between the nature of the One Ring and the nature of the spear as it's described over the last 2,000 years, that it seems to talk to people, it seems to have a will and a goal of its own.
Yeah, as far as I might speculate that it seems to me that it would be a conduit or maybe a method of communication from maybe some dark forces, maybe certain kind of demonic force. You know, I don't know if I would necessarily have to call it the Antichrist. It could be just a very dark entity that uses that as its means of expression.
Right. So we looked at this from a couple of different angles. George is a Christian and believes that Christ really did exist, and that Christ was a divinity, and that Christ, the Word made flesh, when he died, stepped out, and then the spear entered the body, the residue of the Word made flesh. And so George went off, as I said, George went on a tear, and he wrote a whole chapter on combining esoteric Christianity and quantum physics,
mm-hmm.
and that's the chapter of the Quantum Christ.
Right.
And so George looks at a number of possibilities from that angle, that the spear may have actually gone through Jesus to God the Father, may have, since God the Son had stepped out. It was still a divine receptacle, and the spear may have accidentally downloaded the angry God as opposed to the loving God.
Yeah, wow.
I thought that was kind of an odd take on things, but mine wasn't a whole lot odder. I don't believe that any of the spears are the spear. In fact, I'm not even convinced that Jesus even existed. I'm certainly not convinced that him being any sort of divinity. But then I am convinced that there are powers. You know, you a Gallup poll taken around last Christmas found that now this is plus or minus 3%, 98% of Americans believe in the God of the Bible. 85% of Americans believe in angels. 65% believe in devils, and around 40% believe in ghosts. Now that's the supernatural.
Huh.
This object is a relic of the Passion, and relics are a universal religious idea. Every major religion on this planet believes in the power of relics, and the basic idea is that the supernatural is the real universe, where God lives, where the angels live, where the powers live. That's the real universe. And the universe of the senses, the universe that we see, is a smaller place. It's a subset, if you'll use the mathematical term.
Uh-huh.
That the supernatural comes through to us in various ways, and depending on which variety of religion you are, you either see it around you constantly or you hardly ever see it at all. But the idea is that holy men, prophets, saints, are holy men because the supernatural has come through them,
mm-hmm.
and has made them holy, and that they're the relics of them, their bones, their sandals, these things were imbued with, were touched by the supernatural, and so continue to hold a residue,
yeah.
of the supernatural within them, and that the supernatural can be channeled or downloaded.
Uh-huh.
That by being in the presence of the thumb bone of John the Baptist, you can get a hit. You can get a transmission of the supernatural from that realm to this realm via it. And so there is this idea that if this thing were a relic of the Passion, if this thing actually did pierce the Word made flesh, that it may have taken on a supernatural force, that it may have downloaded or channeled or been imbued with some aspect of the supernatural.
Yeah, I can follow most of that. I'm just not sure why it reverses at the end there.
Well,
like,
where I'm looking at this thing at is it just because if it's not a Christian relic, are we just hunks of meat, or are we souls? Are we imperishable spiritual beings? And if we are, do we have power? And what is our power? If you're familiar with psychometry is the psychic practice of learning about people by objects. That a guy, say he keeps a pocket watch on him for 20 years.
Then to me, like, if the spear would touch Jesus and catch his harmonic resonance, it would be of, I don't understand how it becomes evil.
Well, there you go. That's I'm working my way towards it.
Oh, okay.
Okay. So there's a couple of possibilities here that I bring up. And one of the possibilities is that you have an object. The spear has been on display for the last 1,200 years. For the last 1,200 years, a million or more people a year have looked at this thing and believed it had powers, that believed it could do things.
Mm-hmm.
Now, that's a million people a year for 1,200 years. That's like a billion entities looking,
yeah.
at this thing and saying, you have power. You can,
yep.
do things.
I understand that.
Would that give that object power?
Yeah.
Would we actually be able to turn that thing on?
Yeah, I think maybe, yeah.
And then there's the other question. If there are powers out there, and I won't go so far as to say that they're demons and angels, but if there are big beings out there, might there be some that are crazy or evil? And might it not be that if one of them's trucking around one day and he sees this thing on display with all these people lined up looking at it and goes, Huh. Now here's a cool gig. They want a link to the other side. I'll give them a link to the other
side. Yeah, there you go.
Or perhaps just believing that it is a link actually opens the door. You know,
yeah.
Are there entities on the other side just waiting for a peephole, just waiting for a keyhole to come through? And the 1,200 years of looking at this object pushed that hole open big enough for something to come through.
Not to mention the people drawn to seek such a thing are pulling that influence to them as well.
Right, and then we have the other aspect is that the Nazis actively used it in black magic. And this is one of the wild pieces of the tale, is that the Nazis created a special castle to engage in black magic rituals with it and used it for black magic rituals.
Wow.
Now, I know we're running out of time here quickly, but the story goes is that they created a replica of the spear that went from Boadicea up to Adolf Hitler, while the replica went on display in Nuremberg and then ended up in the museum in Vienna, the real one was used for black magic rituals. And then at the end of the war was hidden in Antarctica in 1945. And then the guys who were responsible for hiding it in 1945 go back and get it again in 1979. And that's why the book begins and ends with this event.
Yep.
Because these guys who were using it for black magic rituals during the war may be in possession of it again.
Yeah. So it's, you know, very well could be out there in somebody's hands today, and who knows what they're thinking.
Exactly.
Wow. So, yeah, well, thanks for joining us on the show, Jerry. The fascinating stuff, and,
unfortunately, it was an hour too short.
Well, we got a nice taste of the book and what it has to offer, and if people want to check out more, I just have to go to spearbook.com, right?
That's it, exactly. In fact, secretsoftheholylands.com and spearbook.com are the same place.
Right.
Spearbook.com is just an easy to remember. It's a repeater. You type in spearbook.com. You don't even need the darn W's. It will take you over to Secrets of the Holy Lands.
All right. Thanks for joining us. And we're going to wrap up the show tonight with the music of co-author George Picard and his band The Atomics. I'll give his site one more time, atomiks.com, and the name of the tune is Butchwax. Thank you for listening, everyone. Good night.
You have been listening to BBS Radio, a blogandservice.com production and a service to others endeavor. Thank you very much for tuning into our radio program, and we wish you much peace and joy on your journey.